The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
We now move into our Taisho, our Dharma talk, and I will begin the Taisho this morning, and Melissa will come in at a certain point and finish it. And then tomorrow, David Roshi will give the Taisho. So the koan that we've chosen for our Sesshin, for our Taishos, is from the Gateless Gate, and it's case number 9, Xingrong's non-attained Buddha. A monk asked the priest Xingrong of Xingyang, "The Buddha of supremely pervading, surpassing wisdom did Zazen on the Bodhi seat for 10 kalpas. But the Dharma of the Buddha did not manifest itself, and he could not attain Buddhahood. Why was this?" Xingrong said, "Your question is exactly to the point." The monk said, "But he did Zazen on the Bodhi seat. Why couldn't he attain Buddhahood?" Xingrong said, "Because he is a non-attained Buddha." Wu Men, who compiled this collection, The Gateless Gate, has a comment. "I approve the old barbarian's realization, but I don't approve his understanding. If an ordinary person realizes, they are thus a sage. If a sage understands, they are thus an ordinary person." And here is Wu Men's poem. "Better than knowing the body is knowing the mind in peace. When the mind is realized, the body is no longer anxious. When body and mind are fully realized, the saintly hermit declines to become a noble." So a monk asked the priest Xingrong of Xingyang, "The Buddha of supremely pervading, surpassing wisdom did Zazen on the Bodhi seat for 10 kalpas, but the Dharma of the Buddha did not manifest itself and he could not attain Buddhahood. Why was this?" Sometimes perhaps you've thought to yourself, "Well, I've been doing this practice for a few months now, for a few years now, for some decades now. Isn't something supposed to happen?" Or maybe you're sitting in Zazen and the clear moon is out, no clouds in the sky this time. And maybe a little voice in your head says, maybe something's going to happen any moment now. I say maybe you said this. I would say certainly we all have these moments when we wonder when something's going to happen or if something's about to happen. This is inescapable in our practice. And it's a real dilemma for us because we know perfectly well that there is no attainment. We all just recited that together when we recited the Heart Sutra. We have been told that we're not supposed to have a gaining idea. And so maybe we're moved to reproach ourselves when we have these moments of wondering when something will happen, wondering if something's about to happen. I don't think we should reproach ourselves. I think we should just accept this as part of our practice. It will happen. The question is what to do when it does happen, not to be angry at ourselves that it did. So this koan is an entryway into that. Let's go back to our koan and think about a couple of the exotic terms that come up. The Buddha of supremely pervading, surpassing wisdom did Zazen on the Bodhi seat for 10 kalpas. So what is a kalpa? There are different ways to try to describe it And some of them are rather poetic and whimsical, but here's a very straightforward one from one scholar, which is that a kalpa is 4,320 million years long. So that's quite a long time, 4,320 million years. And 10 kalpas, you can do the math, 43,200 million years. And not only was there that amount of zazen going on, but it was on the Bodhi seat. But he did zazen on the Bodhi seat. What's the Bodhi seat? And our commentaries will tell us that the Bodhi seat is where Shakyamuni Buddha sat under the pipal tree, under the Bodhi tree, when he attained his Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, his perfect, unexcelled enlightenment. And putting those two things together doesn't really make a lot of sense. So we know we're reading a koan. The earth has only been around for 4.5 billion years or so. And this Buddha did zazen for more than 43 billion years. So how could this be? And so we ask ourselves, where is the Bodhi seat really? Do we really think that it's someplace in northern India? Where is your Bodhi seat? There are koans within this koan, and this to me is one of them. Where is the Bodhi seat right now? I admire and I resonate with the note of desperation in this koan. But he did zazen on the Bodhi seat. Why couldn't he attain Buddhahood? We might start by thinking this monk is a little naive. That didn't anybody tell him not to have a gaining idea? He doesn't strike me as so naive. I think maybe he figured that part out a long time ago. And he has devoted himself probably for some years to practice. He's gone through several stages and finds himself still with this great hunger for awakening, finds himself still with this great desire for reassurance that something will happen. And he thinks of this Buddha, this story that he's heard, of a Buddha that did zazen on the Bodhi seat for 10 kalpas. And still, the Buddha Dharma didn't manifest itself. He still didn't attain Buddhahood. Why was this? This is a burning question for this monk. This is not casual. He's not just trying out an idea. He's speaking from his deepest self to his teacher. And his teacher has this wonderful answer. Your question is exactly to the point. Sometimes it takes us years and years and years to get to the question. And until we do that, we can't hope for an answer. We could take, I think if we squint, you know, we could see this answer is kind of snarky. Yeah, great question. But I don't think that Qingrong is being snarky at all. I think that he is being encouraging as he can be at that moment. Your question is exactly to the point. You're asking the right question, but maybe you have become the right question. This monk is just this question at this moment in the koan, or so I'm imagining. The monk said, but he did zazen on the Bodhi seat. Why couldn't he attain Buddhahood? That but, it's almost painful, but he, It reminds me of when we say things like, but I gave it everything, but I did everything I was supposed to, but I devoted myself to this, but, right? But, so why didn't I get the gold medal? Why didn't I get the job? Why don't you love me? And this is the kind of yearning that's coming out in this monk's desperate burning question. Why couldn't he attain Buddhahood? And then at last he gets a second answer. And this answer seems a little bit more direct than the one before. Your question is exactly to the point. Maybe it's not. Maybe they were both direct. Maybe they're both oblique. Xingrong said, because he is a non-attained Buddha. This too, we could take in various ways. Maybe if we're in the mood for it, we could see it as a kind of put down, like, because he's a non-attained Buddha, so, you know, shut up already. But again, I think that this teacher is speaking with compassion and not with annoyance or exasperation. Because he is a non-attained Buddha, another paradox for us. Isn't a Buddha someone who has attained complete unexcelled enlightenment? But here's a non-attained Buddha. Here's a Buddha of non-attainment. How do we understand that? How do we process that? How do we become that? And perhaps Melissa will address those questions.
Oh, thank you, Alan. I was feeling so pulled in by your words and really enjoying them so much. And also, I don't know how many of you heard the second Taisho that was going on in the background. Alan is cat sitting and the cat was meowing. And I thought, wow, that's a great Dharma talk right there. Just who knows what that cat wants? Something, something. Talk to me, talk to me. I want some attention, maybe. It's so beautiful. One of the things that I particularly love about this koan, and I think Alan so clearly explicated it, is the kindness of the teacher. I'm in agreement that I think he was doing the best he could with a person who comes just like all of us and thinks, wait a minute, I thought this was going to be something else. I thought it was a self-improvement program. I thought I was going to be more compassionate, wiser, at ease, no more trouble. That's what I thought Zen was going to do. And of course, Zen offers so much more than that, something so much more important in a way. A clarity around what it means to be a human being. Human beings long for something different than what's here. This person that they're talking about, the Buddha, he was a Buddha, an already fulfilled Buddha, an awakened one. So why didn't he realize the awakening? There's so many layers in this koan. In another translation from a colleague named Guo Gu, who's a Chinese-American Chan teacher from Florida, He translates the last line rather than saying he's a non-attained Buddha, which is just all by itself a wonderful koan. He just says pretty much like Zhaozhou said in the koan Mu, because he didn't. Why didn't he attain it? Because he didn't. No attaining. So another just slight variation, but it means the same thing. What does it mean to attain something? In the spirit in which we were talking earlier before breakfast, this feeling that everything should be one way, but really if we address life the way it actually appears. Things are always changing. Sometimes we're asleep and sometimes we're awake. Sometimes it's daytime and sometimes it's nighttime. And we imagine, we have such powerful imaginations. We think that things could be different, that we could be different, that we could be happier, that we could avoid suffering. This practice is not about avoiding suffering. This practice is about developing the capacity to turn towards what's difficult. Someone was saying to me recently that the feeling of watching the news, watching the news about Ukraine is so devastating that she must not be doing her practice correctly. And of course, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many teachers who've come before me, this is just the perfect Zen response to what's happening in the world, to have our hearts broken by the suffering in the world and also by the suffering that we feel in our own lives, broken open, completely dissolved in what we see and feel and hear that's going on. Every moment on this planet, someone is dying. Someone is taking their last breath. Sometimes that death is easeful and sometimes it's violent, but it's happening all the time. And just like the little cat who's saying, pay attention to me, I want something, we human beings are always wanting. We want things to not be this way. The Tibetan teacher Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche used to talk about all of us are not only already attained, awakened Buddhas, but we're also already bodhisattvas, wisdom beings who go into the world with our broken hearts to do what we can, to do what is unique to our karma and personality. What is it that we can do? So the thing I get to do is teach Zen. I don't know how to repair a car or install technology so that we can meet on Zoom and in the Zendo at the same time. That's beyond me. But there are some things I can do. So I do them, like right now, giving a Dharma talk. Every one of us has these different skills and different foibles, different limps, as David Roshi calls them. All of us have gifts and all of us have limitations. And the limitations are Dharma gates, even more than the gifts are. Every time we're confronted with something that we just can't get through, we can't quite understand, a koan that's given to us, like this teacher, Chinrung, who says, your question is exactly to the point. What a wonderful thing to say to someone who thinks, no, I'm flawed, I'm confused, I don't understand. I've been sitting, as Alan said, for such a long time. Why aren't things better? Why am I not better? Why am I not the image that I have of these heroic bodhisattvas? So Chogyam Trungpa says, broken-hearted bodhisattvas. We are hopefully able to bear a certain kind of suffering so that we don't shut down. And of course, here's the wonderful, tricky thing about the non-attained Buddha, shutting down and wanting things to be different and looking for self-improvement are all aspects of Buddhahood, according to our Zen tradition. Everything that arises, we can't take a little knife and carve away portions of the self. So your difficulties, your suffering, your having a part of a cough drop go down your throat while you're trying to give a Dharma talk, all of this is happening just right. There's no problem. And yet, of course, there is a problem. As Isa says, the great Japanese poet, in one of our readings in our book, a famous poem that he wrote when his small daughter, I think she was 3 years old, died. He said, this world of do is a world of do. In other words, yes, yes, I understand. Everything comes and goes. Even my daughter's death is just another thing happening. But he also might have said, even my grief is another thing happening. Even what I perceive in the world, this suffering, burning world, is just what happens. But his last line is, and yet, and of course he's pointing to his broken heart. As much as we philosophize about everything being Buddha and everything being just the way it is, and this Buddha who sat on the Bodhi seat being a non-attained Buddha, there's something else in us that cries out in these moments, but as Alan said, but I want it to be different. And this is, of course, what Shakyamuni Buddha, our historical Buddha, this other Buddha we're talking about, was one of the precursors to our historical Buddha, Shakyamuni. There are many other Buddhas who lived before the Buddha of the current age. He says, he's a non-attained Buddha. He says, your question is exactly to the point. The teacher says this about this Buddha who sat and sat and sat, already an awakened one. What's going on here? I love the line from Hakuin Meikaku in our text, the Song of Zazen, where he says, it's like someone in the midst of water crying out in thirst. In other words, we don't know that we're already in the best possible place to be. We already are the best possible person we can be. But because we compare that to something else, some fantasy of a heavenly abode or a perfected being, we miss what's right here. All the water we need to satisfy our thirst, already present, already here. There's one more thing that I want to say about all this that occurred to me while I was listening to Alan's part of the talk. It's a poem that I've shared before in various places, so you may have heard it. It's by a Spanish poet named Juan Ramon Jimenez, and I'm going to just pull it up on my phone because I can do that. The poem is called Oceans, and it points to a particular way that human beings are built. We have brains that can't perceive gradual change. There have been many, many studies, neurological studies done about this, psychological studies, that when things happen suddenly, we're built for suddenness. We can perceive something that happens suddenly, but when it happens gradually, like our child getting older or ourselves getting older or things happening to the planet gradually that are so destructive, we don't notice them. We're not built that way. We're not constructed to perceive gradual change. And of course, the other side of this wonderful koan is that we actually do become wiser and more compassionate and more equanimous as we continue practicing this way. We actually do have insights. Even though everything is already here, everything is in process. So we can't tell what's going on, but we have each other to help us as mirrors. We can reflect this. We can see that we may not be heading in the direction of the fantasy of a perfected Buddha or a heavenly abode to live in, but we are experiencing something that's different. So Juan Ramon Jimenez says this. The poem is called Oceans. And this is sometimes a feeling I have at Sashin especially, but it happens quite often. He says, I have a feeling that my boat has struck down here in the depths against a great thing. I have a feeling that my boat has struck down there in the depths against a great thing. And don't we have these experiences sometimes at Sesshin or just even in daily life? Suddenly, we actually hear the sound of a bird singing. We actually see the green of a new leaf on a tree. We actually taste our food and feel the loving touch of another. We actually feel it not as an idea, but right there, immediately. And it's like we've struck against some great thing. And so here's what Juan Ramon Jimenez says about that. I have a feeling that my boat has struck down there in the depths against a great thing, and nothing happens. Nothing. Silence. Waves. Nothing happens, or has everything happened? And are we standing now, quietly, in the new life? Has everything happened? And are we standing now, quietly, in the new life? We don't have the capacity to self-evaluate. We need teachers and Sangha for that. But maybe we can learn to trust that something is moving. Something is not being attained exactly, but something is showing itself to us in a way that we could never have predicted with all our fantasies of what it means to be awake or enlightened or realized. It's never like what we fantasize or imagine. It's always a surprise. Unimaginable, not attained because not predicted, but already here. So this is the challenge that Wu Men gives us in telling us this story that Alan and I are pointing to today, that David will point to tomorrow. Already here, and yet, how is it right now? Stay awake to your life, and when you are lost and confused, stay awake to that. Everything is coming forward to teach you. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and Alan and David and I will do our best to respond to any comments or questions you have about the talk or the koan or anything that's coming up for you around meditation practice. And we'll count on, yes, Corwin, for to let us know who's raising their hand in the Zendo. So Boundless Way Temple, you're on.
I don't know if anybody else has anything to say, but I do. Thank you both for that talk. And part of me was thinking, sitting here going, will you get out of my head? probably because it was my brain was primed from the readings that we did. But as we were walking and kinking, I was thinking ahead to what was next. And I often do that during the full sutra service because I don't want to screw it up. So I was sitting there going, the Dharma is rarely encountered, and incomparably profound, all that. And I was thinking to myself, it's like, well, the Dharma is incomparably profound and infinitely subtle, and we encounter it all the time. What do you mean? And then I thought of it and went, oh, but we just don't realize that we're encountering it because we're thinking in the next moment like I'm doing right now. But my moment is to not be. As you were talking, this was going through my head and going, Yeah, this is exactly the point, isn't it? And you were kind of blowing my mind because I really felt like we had sort of the same mind going for a little bit. But anyway, thank you.
That particular chant, it really speaks to the what's often called in Buddhism the preciousness of human birth. Mm. Because the Dharma is always, as you said, Corman, always there, always manifesting. But when we're a hell being, or when we're an asura, or even a deva, even a god, we can't receive it the way we can receive it in a human birth. So the Dharma is always manifesting, but you and me, we're not always able to receive it. So this chant reminds us to open up to it, to open our hearts, to open our minds, and be prepared to be blown away.
Yeah, thank you. Anne.
Yeah, I find myself putting this in the same pot with not knowing and not thinking and not attaining, all of which I have trouble with. And I've come to terms with it by thinking that my definition of knowing, thinking, and attaining isn't broad enough. That you could say not knowing, you just move it over slightly to a different kind of knowing. And maybe the attaining is just a different kind of attaining, which isn't in my standard way of thinking of attaining. That's it.
Anne, I appreciate you. Dogen talked about this when he talked about moving through the many and the one, moving through attainment and non-attainment, moving through understanding and not understanding. There's something else. We think reality is constrained by language, and actually our language is just a kind of rough pointer to something that is beyond that. So I love this possibility. Yes, we still use words, but when the category shifts, suddenly it's beyond the limited, you know, yes or no, black or white, and we get to, we might say we get to live in technicolor. So thanks, Anne.
Yeah, Esther.
So something in Alan's talk about, you know, the longing to be in a place of more freedom or less suffering or more wisdom and just handling myself and life in some way better or with more lightness and ease, you know, the sentence came to me, well, maybe I'm getting better.
Oh, did that happen?
Is it connection?
Did that happen to anybody else or just us?
We lost you for a minute.
Oh, we lost you for a moment. Keep going.
Say it again. The sentence or the phrase that came.
Too bad.
Esther, we can't hear you. Now.
You know what, Esther, turn off your video for a moment. Maybe we'll be able to hear you.
Okay, I'll try that. I'll try. Is that better?
We can hear you.
Oh, now we can hear you. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's try this.
So, this experience that I'm having at maybe the getting to know suffering is what is part of what's happening. So rather than with time and with practice that we are relieved or we become, you know, the questions like, did I not do well enough? Did I not love well enough? Did I not put all my best into it? And what we come to know something about is suffering and really getting to know suffering. Because my experience is it's unfolding and with more shades and nuances and more difficult also. It's not like it's getting easier, but there is an intimacy with
Well, exactly. It's
suffering that is possible.
The fantasy again is that I'm going to be able to bear suffering more easily. It won't be so bothersome. But the reality, as you're tasting, is that it's actually even more bothersome. This is what Trungpa Rinpoche was pointing out, that it breaks your heart, you know, it breaks us down. It's not about being kind of having it all together. And it becomes technicolored, it becomes vivid, it becomes more precious in a way, you know, that suffering becomes part of what's happening in the world, not a problem or an exception.
And I'm reminded of an artist I studied with, a sculptor, and I was working in clay, and I was at a particular place with a sculpture, and I just couldn't figure out what needed to happen next, and it was really painful. And I went to him and I said, you know, I'm at this place and I just don't know what to do, and I'm really worried. And he said, oh, don't worry, it just gets worse. So
it's true. Oh, you know, my goodness.
And I think maybe that's a little bit of what Anne was saying too. Yeah, the vividness and this possibility of a new definition of what it means to be awake.
Yeah, when I was first starting in Zazen, maybe I'd been sitting for a few years, I heard Pema Chodron give a talk. I was very excited because you know, she had written all these books and I thought she was really cool. And she was, I just got the end of her talk and it was wonderful. She was saying, when I first, this is Pema talking, when I first started in practice, I thought that my life would get easier, you know, and that water would nourish me and the wind would cool me and fire would warm me and what other element am I missing? Anyway, you get the idea. And then, so I was thinking, yeah, so that's not my experience. What is she going to say? It just gets worse. And she actually said, but when you are really practicing hard, you know it, because water drowns you. And with the earth buries you, and et cetera, the fire burns you up. And that seemed right to me. That had been my experience. So here you are naming it, and that artist that David met naming it. It doesn't get better, because the getting better is the fantasy of what's supposed to happen. But the reality is more alive, more present, more here. Thank you. Lara.
I was really touched by both of you pointing to the compassion of the teacher. I think I've had this following me since yesterday. I work as a therapist, and in particular, yesterday, there was so much desire for attaining, which is really part of the job. I understand that, you know, people are wanting to attain ease and less suffering. And for some reason, yesterday was really challenging for me to sit with that. I was like, well, why do we have to attain so many things? I was thinking all of this, you know, and I was trying to keep steering them in some practice of being with, and they're, every one of my clients was just like railing against it. I do not want to do this. And I was taking it really personally. You know, I was like feeling something in me just kept grating. And it was like client after the client, like, there's no way that's what we should be doing. You know, there must be some way of attaining. And my, you know, I've sat with like for a while, just, how could I have been more compassionate? Or what was the agitation about? And I think what kind of listening to both your talks about it was just, I noticed that like, I had that same desire, you know, it was so agitating for me sitting with them, was just that, like, that part that I was that student too, saying like, how could this be, you know? So yeah, it was really helpful, because this has been like grating in me a lot, and it has really just, yeah, it's helped me see the compassionate teacher in both them and in me.
It's interesting to put your contribution together with Esther's, right? Because as a therapist, and maybe sometimes as a teacher, you want to take the suffering away. You want to make things better. You're touched to the core by this cry for help. And yet Esther's suggesting, well, maybe the suffering has to get more intense. Maybe the freedom involves an undefendedness that just cranks it up. And at the same time, I really honor your wish to be able to soothe the waters and you know, pour oil on them. But I don't think we have that oil to pour.
Well, you know, I just had the thought rise too. there is something comforting and nourishing about this practice. If we weren't getting something, we wouldn't do it. It's just that we get so lost in these fantasies about what is supposed to be happening. So there is comfort, there is nourishing, there is companionship. It really is happening. As I said, you know, we just don't see gradual change, but we really are ripening. And yeah, it's not an easy thing to understand with the ordinary mind, but yeah.
Well, and Laura, as you talk, and Alan, this, you know, we don't have any oil to pour over the water. And yet, Laura, even as you're talking about this, and Corwin was saying the same thing, oh, it's okay, right? It's not what we thought. It's not like the waves go down or the wishing to remove the suffering, but we go, oh, this is just wishing it were different,
right?
Right? It's like, and then we can rest right where we are. Right.
We're the Buddha of wishing things were different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
And, thanks,
and,
Laura.
Thanks, Laura. And Ray.
Yeah, thank you for your talk. And I was reflecting on the heart that breaks and the meaning of suffering. And the heart that is associated for me with great love and compassion, how could it not want to embrace the world and all that it contains? And that means the suffering that is part of it. And it there's something about embracing that suffering that, at least for me, touches my deepest humanity and makes me grateful to be alive. And that for me is an incredibly, I don't know what to call it, but transformative spiritual experience in itself. So just that maybe at the depths of that suffering, maybe at its very core is love, you know, just that, you know.
Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate, go ahead, Alan.
Oh, I was just gonna say, Ray, in response that there's that line in one of our sutra dedications, Guan Yin finds us in the dark and broken roads. And I always feel that that's reversible. When we're in the dark and broken roads is when we discover Guan Yin, when we find the Bodhisattva of compassion able to arise in us. And this is what you've just said in your own way. So beautifully, the compassion wells out of the broken place.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you, Tom.
This is an interesting discussion. I come from the opposite place culturally with this, which is what I have to guard against is locking on to my suffering, and attaching to it, so, as if I'm not suffering, I'm not alive. Mm-hmm. I have trouble with the balance.
There's a part two to what Alan was just saying that I was thinking of, that your question is exactly to the point. I just had to say that. But when Guan Yin meets us in the dark and broken roads, when we meet Guan Yin, there's a trust that begins to arise that Guan Yin can be responsible for our suffering, that we don't have to be responsible for it. It's not our suffering. It's not some little thing that belongs to us personally. That's where the trouble arises. And we become attached, as you say. So many people are like you. I mean, who would I be without my suffering?
Right.
Wonderful cartoon of the guy holding onto a big boulder and saying, "My stone, my stone. Who would I be without my stone?" And then you see that he's sinking down to the bottom of the ocean, and he says, "Oh, on the other hand," drowning with it. But this is where the part of our practice is to not give the suffering over to the little separate self, but realize that Guan Yin, the spirit of love, the spirit of compassion that exists in every religious and spiritual tradition in some form or other, Mother Earth in indigenous traditions, or Mary in Christianity, Shekinah in Judaism, there's always some representation of this receiving the suffering of the world. So Kanan means Kanseyan Avalokiteshvara. It means the one who hears the sounds of the world, and you can give everything over to her. And then you don't lose it. just recognize it's not really yours.
Thank you.
So should we have one more, maybe? Yeah. Modu?
Yeah, so where this koan sort of took me is, the word non-attainment. And then I'm thinking, but this non-attainment still has to be attained. It's what I'm
beautifully said.
So then I'm thinking, is this non-attainment already attained without me attaining it?
Mm-hmm.
So that's my question, or the answer, or the point.
Yeah. Right, exactly to the point.
Yeah, I think your question is right there in the hot spot.
Okay, got it.
This hot spot, and how do we stay in the hot spot long enough that it's not nothing and it's not something? It's not attainment and it's not non-attainment, and you get it, you'll get hit by the Zen teacher no matter what. You say this, right? Is it this? No. Is it not this? No. No. Yes. No. Right. And this is the lively point of it beyond comprehension.
Just stay there for 10 kalpas.
I said 43, Billy, I will. Yeah. Thank you, everyone. We'll come back into our posture for meditation, and then our practice leaders will take us to the next place.